The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
But first, let's go to a legend of Irish music. Bob Geldof is well known as the lead singer of the Boomtown Rats and creator of Live Aid. But before all the fame and glory, he worked in an abattoir, bussed, was a pea canner and an underground music editor. He left school without doing his intercert. We caught up with him at the Talent Summit this week in Dublin, and I first asked him about his life in business. He successfully found and sold a number of companies and has invested in many others. The rich lists say he's worth over 50 million euro. I first asked him whether he feels that he's good at business. But be warned, there's bad language throughout the interview.
No, I know I'm good at business, but it's just a function. It's easy. You know, yes, it's easy. One is two at the end, you know. You've just got to determine how much of yourself you're prepared to put into it. And, you know, all I know is that if I get something noodling around in my head, then 100% of me will go into it until it just can't anymore. So like every business person, I've had at least as many successes as failures. And there was a big thing, do you remember a few years back, you've got to fail before you can succeed. That's not true. As soon as I pitched up in Canada, I was on my way to the gold mines up in the Arctic Circle. I could drive heavy machines. That's all I could do to dig gold. But I stopped off to get my illegal immigration papers in Vancouver, and I got a job. I lied my way into an underground newspaper and ended up in 3 months having control of 50% of the paper, writing about music, which, you know, I've always loved. But then my vanity was scorched by the fact that, like, you know, not enough people were reading these pearls of wisdom that everyone should. This music is shit. This is what you need to be listening to. Roxy music, Lou Reed, David Bowie, fuck the rest, you know. And I went to the owner. It was this, Rolling Stone was a local underground paper, etc. It was deeply political. And I said, look, people just want to read about the music. He goes, oh, yeah, but we need to get an advertiser. He needs to pick his lower lip, this sort of stringy Dickensian type character, pebble glasses. And I said, if I can double the circulation in 2 weeks, will you give me control of the whole circulation? And he went, yeah. So I went to the printers and I asked him to quadruple the circulation by eliminating the colour front page. And then I went to the universities, and myself and another guy working on the paper, we just dumped thousands of free black and white copies in the three universities, thousands. So overnight, I quadrupled the circulation. So McLeod had to give me control of that. But with quadrupling it, I could then sell ads to the record companies and the radio stations who now are vested in this. So I had access to all the stars and started promoting gigs in Vancouver, and then being a smart arse and now getting on radio, the Mounties are, who is this little fucker, you know? And they got their man, and I was fucked out and came back to Ireland and with 2,000 bucks.
You could have been a Randolph Hearst, a Rupert Murdoch. It was all there.
Because I started a newspaper called Buy and Sell. That was it. So my thing was to start a paper that would make money, and with the money I'd start a rock and roll paper that would make no money but would invest Ireland with a sense of possibility, which is what I also got out of rock and roll. These other universes were there of change, because there were no rock and roll posters, no rock and roll radio, no rock and roll magazines, no rock and roll television, no rock and roll gigs, three pubs where you could play pop in Dublin. So that needed to be done. Buy and Sell didn't happen for me. I had all the artwork, had everything. I looked like something out of Guantanamo Bay at the time. I had beard and long hair. I was 19, 20. I'd been in a decent school, Black Rock College. So I got my mates' dads, who were accountants and lawyers, to draw up the business plan, which I still have. It's a ball breaker. If I showed it to you, you'd invest now. And the guy paid no attention, Donnybrook, AIB, I think. And he looks at me at the end. He says, tell me now, Kilduff. Tell me now, Mr. Kilduff, what age are you at? And I said, 20. He said, oh, yeah. I tell you what, come back when you're 40. That's why I got out.
When you look at personality and your reputation, your reputation for being a guy who calls it as he is, as it is, for being angry about stuff, for speaking out. In the world of business, people think that to succeed, you've got to do a bit of schmoozing. Have you ever schmoozed? Have you ever played that game?
Yeah, until I realise it's not working, and then Boomtown Bob comes out, you know. And of course you do. And doing these things at this conference, the networking thing is immense.
In terms of your own life, your own wealth, do you like spending money that you have? What's a luxury for you? What do you enjoy spending money on?
I have to constantly tell myself that I've got enough to pay the bills, because for most of my life, you didn't. So, I bollocked the missus because she doesn't turn the lights off. Turn off the lights. But now I use the old, you know, planetary warming thing, you know. Like, I can't say the fucking bills are enormous, you know. They are, as they are for everyone. But I go, God, I can afford that. Literally, I just say that to myself. I can afford. I don't like bling particularly. I don't even really enjoy it on others. I like the vibe of it, you know. I like the look, sort of this sort of cheap Roman look, you know. But remember, I said I wanted wealth when I was a kid. What do you want to get out of rock and roll? You know, I want to get rich. I want to get famous. I want to get laid. But I said why, you know, rich.
You managed all three, Bob.
I did, yeah. And I wanted fame to talk about the things that bother me. You wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here if it was just business. Getting shagged in 1975, Catholic Garden, forget it. And wealth because it, you know, it gives you the ability, it gives you flexibility. It allows you to function in a world like this.
What do you think about the whole debate about the super wealthy in society and whether or not they're taxed enough, whether they're paying enough tax, decisions that they make about philanthropy and giving money to good causes ends up maybe being, in some cases, a tiny percentage of their overall wealth?
I don't mind it being a tiny percentage of their overall wealth. I think Bill Gates is a very good man. He's socially awkward, clearly a genius. The fact is Bill Gates may be an individual in history that can eliminate one of the greatest scourges of human history itself, so polio or perhaps malaria, those two he focuses on, one person. So if it needed vast wealth to do that, Bill, take my money. On the other hand, he thought he could gather up people in a sort of billionaire's band-aid and get them to commit all their money. So Buffett's daughter I know quite well, and she's a wonderful girl and is quite happy that she won't get her dad's vast billions, you know, quite happy. But where I agree with you is that it should not be up to an individual to pick and choose. It needs society to decide its priorities. Billionaires need to be taxed appropriately. Well done them. I don't really have a problem with the wealthy. But, you know, there needs to be, like, you know, I believe that the tech giants immediately need to be broken up. They're an inhibitor to competition. You know, it's what VCs call the kill zone. Now that they're so powerful, anything in their past they destroy or buy and, you know, suppress. Zuckerberg is a dangerous person because he's not that clever. And these people are, you know, using us. We're the product, in case you didn't know, and we're giving up ourselves for convenience. It's appalling. And it needs to be seriously regulated.
Does it feel good to be out of Brexit Britain? Do you still feel as strongly about Brexit as you did during the referendum campaign?
Oh, well, clearly I feel it's a catastrophic mistake from a social and political point of view. I think immediately it's an economic mistake, but I don't believe that's going to pertain for much longer. I mean, people forget that this is a hugely dynamic, innovative people. I think they'll do a deal with the European Union because it's 65 million people who are heavily vested in consumption, consumerism. It would be stupid, literally stupid. I mean, the same thing that drives me nuts about the whole Brexit argument for the French through Barnier to insist on, you know, damaging trade across the European Union, particularly when Britain has withdrawn its annual fees and Romania and Bulgaria and the South desperately needs subsidisation. So that would be stupid. And almost possibly in a very unstable political entity like the EU, probably one of the final nails if they're not careful. So they must do a deal. The deal with America, again, look what the Brits are actually doing, never mind the nonsense. The deal currently being talked about over 8 years is 0.16 of the UK economy. In no way does it compensate for a trade deal with the EU. Its measurable terms are seriously negligible because politically they cannot do a deal with the NHS, they cannot do an agriculture deal, and that's frankly all the Yanks are interested in. Socially, culturally, I believe it's tragic. My whole argument from the beginning is that if Britain is the loose thread on the EU jumper, a frayed jumper indeed, and it's pulled, and it has been, that the whole thing unravels. And with that in mind, the European countries remaining, particularly Ireland, which has a vastly vested interest in it, the whole success of Ireland, either pre the Tiger or emerging from the Tiger, is predicated on access to this vast free trade bloc. It's also extremely young. Ireland's figures, mathematics, science and reading, which are the key figures for the future, are 17th in the world in science and maths. That's 5 above UK. That's 10 above the United States. And in reading, 5th in the world. Singapore is first across all of them. Very young population, educated. So go. You know, Ireland is on go. There's the takeoff strip there. But fucking, you know, Varadkar did a blinder, man. You know, there's no bloody border with the UK, and there's no border, let's face it, and there's no border with Europe. That's the reality of this. So in terms of Irish business, there's great opportunity. In terms of Britain, it isn't isolating itself because the entire history of Britain is non-isolationist. But will Britain recover? I don't think it'll be particularly damaged, and I think in 8 years it'll be business as usual.
To take the music analogy with Britain today and post-Brexit Britain and Boris's Britain, is it ripe for a new punk, or is this the modern 21st century punk? What's happening?
Trump and Brexit are punk. It's a rejection of all norms, and in Trump's case of behaviour, of civic dignity, political norms. In some cases, disruption is useful. It is creative disruption. In the case of the United States, it's just destruction. The man is a fool. And the much, no pun intended, trumped, economic resurgence of America is a bald lie. It is built on $1.9 trillion of debt, which uniquely America can possibly sustain because it just prints bucks, being the reserve currency. But that's up for grabs within 8 to 10 years with China. But he'll be out of there by then. But the nature of the confusion and chaos of the world leads to individuals like mafia gangsters like Putin or wankers like Boris Johnson. That's it. And Brexit is classically punk. Dominic Cummings is, just that. The difference is
Johnny Rotten
was creative. Johnny Rotten was a brilliant paradigm of the now. Johnny made genius music. Boris Johnson will not create one of the greatest economies. He is not. He's just, all he wanted was power. He's unprincipled. He has no idea what to do with this thing. They flounder around making their silly juvenile punkish type things, getting rid of the institutions that they require to govern in the first place. So stand by for chaos. Johnny Rotten created the void in which new music could grow, and in so doing got rid of the old tired war horses.
When you talk about music, you talk about punk. It was actually a guitarist that I heard interviewed on radio some time back from a punk band, a female guitarist, talking about how music and lyrics can no longer change the world, that it's actually lost that power. That if anything, a lot of the music that's out there is very good quality, but not in a way that music of the past was able to change the society that we live in. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but you don't look to rock and roll to do that anymore, because something else has supplanted that function of rock and roll, and that's the thing we all have in our back pocket, the toxicity of the web. So for 50 years, Prior to 1956, music was specifically that, as it is today. So the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, wonderful music. I mean, they're called the classics. I mean, people keep doing albums of this great music. But Rodgers and Hammerstein never set out to put an attitude across. They set out to create music that you could live by, as I think one of Frank Sinatra's albums is. Frank began to understand you could use music to change things when he completely refused to operate in the southern states if his black players couldn't stay in the same hotel with them. And this began to burgeon. But it was as a result of Elvis and Little Richard. And so then from that period on, you get an articulation of the economy and the culture, specifically more articulated with the contemptuous insolence of the Stones, the chirpy lack of deference of the Beatles, the roadmap of Bob Dylan, and on until the year 2000. The last gasp of attitudinal rock and roll would be Oasis, Blur, Nirvana. And then the web comes and you get craft, ability and talent, very like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Wonderful music. Sheeran, craft coming out his arse. I gasp at, like, every note is a hook. You know, there's a riff. I mean, it's my job, but I don't set out to write them. I played with Ed and Beyonce last year in South Africa. And just Beyonce is just too beautiful a human being, like, just gorgeous, like, you know, what was God on an off day, you know, just pure beauty, you know, and genius talent. And but it's great. And her husband is giving it large attitude, but he's a billionaire now, so the whole NWA thing doesn't work anymore, you know. So, you know, so what they do, like, you know, Lewis Capaldi, this doofus, this fat doofus from Scotland, you know, everyone loves him, you know, because he's nice, you know, nice guy, nice music. Billie Eilish, great music. But is that going to, you know, rock the world, tilt it on its axis a bit? No, because that's not the function. Now ideas, moral, political, cultural, social, once transmitted through the rock heroes of our time, their attitude is now comes through what like preferences you have on the web. Unfortunately, the web is a narrowing of options.
You're about to start a new tour with the Boomtown Rats. How do you feel about that? What about, is it exhausting? Is it exhilarating after all these years going back to it?
It's both. You know, I'm tired now because a new book, a new single, a new album, a new movie, a new tour. And it all has to come to a head at the same time.
Are you worried about the coronavirus?
I am, because I'm prone to, you can hear now already, I didn't have a cold yesterday, I do now, so I just get colds all the time. I'm used to it. But we had to cancel Magdeburg 4 days ago because the local health authority would not give my agent a letter saying that he could guarantee our safety. Now, I'm responsible for 13 people travelling. 25% of flights from Germany have been cancelled. So what if we're stuck? What if we're quarantined for 14 days or we're suddenly quarantined in a warehouse in Heathrow and we've got an album and a tour coming out, can't afford it. So we had to stop. So it's the consequences of uncertainty, which is a business proposition as well as everything else.
Why do it though, Bob, in a sense? Tour, new album, new song, film. Why bother? What drives you to do it? Why do you want to do it?
Because business is all empirical. I can give you clear answers to all your questions on that. One and one is two.
You don't need the money.
I don't, but that's not the issue. I mean, you know, doing these talks, you make a lot of money, you know. But so why do it? I don't know. You know, I like thinking. I like noodling ideas that they ask me to think about. Being on stage is not an issue. You know, I'm perfectly at home with that. The opportunities of meeting wildly different people. You know, just like, you know, the other day talking about coronavirus, we had to open the stem cell research laboratories in Toronto. Why? Why ask Bob Geldof, you know? I don't know. But yeah, OK, I'll go to Toronto. Wedge is great. Let me think about stem cells here for a minute. And what's it got to do with Toronto? Turns out they believe They own it. They discovered them in 1966. The SARS outbreak vis-a-vis corona, the epicenter was Toronto. And the woman running that would go to work every day dressed like Dustin Hoffman in Outbreak, and the hospital was swathed in thick plastic. So we go there. We are taken around the labs and shown just this incredible, these worlds inside atomic microscopes. These universes of living things, like bright pink with silvery filaments all moving around and, you know, sidling up to this lime green other creature going, gum, and eating them. And you go, that's insane. And the most beautiful of them all was a tiny, well, obviously tiny because you can't see with your eye, was a single heart cell, a single heart, and it beat, boom, boom. It knew what it was. It was meant to be a heart. Isn't that cool? I mean, I wanted to buy it for a Valentine's, you know. And so, we were talking afterwards at the Do with all these dudes, and they were saying, I was saying, will you be able to resolve this? And literally it was down to, yeah, we think we'll be able to grow an arm. Will you be able to solve Alzheimer's? No, that's not in our problem. Anyway, they were all going on, and the woman who's now in charge of this, who ran the SARS, she was listening, and she eventually said, it won't make any difference, Bob. And I said, well, why? And she said, because there's a chicken in China right now, and it's breeding a little bug, and we won't be able to stop that because the supply chains of the world, transportation. And she said, before it's lived its life, 60% of the world will be gone. So that's utter collapse. That's the Black Death. And it's not coronavirus. But that little fucker, as per Yeats in The Second Coming, is being born and slouching towards its own Bethlehem, you know. It will happen. It may not be that, but something akin is the thing that'll put it all out of shape. Would I have thought that? Would I have been exposed to that? Would I have been exposed to that brain power, to that beauty of whole unseen universes? Absolutely not. So why do I do it? Because of all of that. And that spins off in my head, and then there's a pop song that may be a hit. And then I get to play that. And when I'm on that stage, then I don't have to think about coronavirus or doubt or equivocation or the bottom line of some company in Africa. I just go wild and go free.
Bob Geldof, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
You're welcome.
Bob Geldof there.